I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, Friday mornings at 9. Join me as we explore topics like health and wellness, prosperity, inner peace, the law of attraction, and more. Tap into good vibrations to start your weekend feeling uplifted and optimistic. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Good morning. Welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks for being with us today. You might be listening in Vancouver at CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, empowerradio.com, cosmicdimensions.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. Wherever you're listening from, thank you for being with us today. And today's guest is Brad Warner. He is the author of a book called Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. So I just want to put a disclaimer out there that we may be discussing some adult-related content. We will be, because we're going to be talking about sex. So listener discretion is advised. Hi, welcome to the show, Brad.
Hi, I'll try to be clean.
All right.
For everybody.
Yeah, no F-bombs in the morning.
Yeah.
All right, so you are a Zen Buddhist monk?
That's right, yeah.
So how did you get in? How did you get into to that?
Well, kind of accidentally. I was a student at Kent State University in Ohio. I was, my passion was punk rock. I was in a hardcore band. I was really kind of dedicated to that. But I found the scene was sort of lacking. And around the same time, I took a class at the university called Zen Buddhism, kind of on a whim. The title looked interesting, and I didn't know what Zen Buddhism was. So it just changed my life. I heard what it seemed to be everything that I was kind of looking for in the punk rock scene, which was this kind of questioning attitude towards everything, but taken to the ultimate degree, where it was a religion that wasn't afraid, I thought of it as a religion at the time, that wasn't afraid to question its own doctrines, even, which I thought was amazing.
And so you mentioned you thought it was a religion at the time, and in the book,
yeah.
I guess there's some debate as to whether it is a religion or not.
Yeah, and I could depending on your definition of the word religion, I could go either way. It does have some aspects that are like a religion, and so sometimes I can accept it being called a religion. But I think ultimately it's not, because religions tend to take the view, any religion I know of takes the view that the spiritual side of our being is the most important thing, whereas the material side of our being is less or maybe non-existent in some cases. And Buddhism doesn't take that approach. It takes the approach that both are equally important, but neither one is true reality. So spirit isn't true reality and matter isn't true reality. The real reality is something that contains and includes both.
Interesting. Okay. So now I want to talk about sex. I've been wanting to talk about sex on this show for so long.
Oh, great.
Yeah. But, you know, because it's a spirituality show,
yeah.
I feel nervous talking about sex because I don't want to offend anyone. And so I can imagine that what were your feelings about sex and sexuality when you went out exploring this and set out to write this book?
Well, it's been, since I discovered Buddhist practice when I was about 18 or 19 years old, the subject of what was and wasn't proper sexually has always been part of my practice. You know, I find that I kind of discovered sex and Buddhism almost at the same time. So it was always at the forefront. And so these questions were big deals throughout my life. And like you say, with spirituality, you wonder if you can talk about sex. But I think it's important to talk about it because it's a real aspect of our lives. And the thing about Buddhist practice in the West is that really the idea of being a celibate monk is, I don't think it's disappeared entirely, but it's not what most of us are coming to the practice with the intention of being celibate monks. And it, And if you're a part of the Japanese lineages, which I am, even monks are not required to be celibate. So you immediately, you have a question of what is proper sexual behavior. If the rules of the game say that it's okay to do it, then there must be something more than that. And all you're kind of left with in the Zen tradition is this precept which says do not misuse sexuality, but it's never clearly defined.
And so in your opinion, what would be a misuse of sexuality?
Well, there are obvious things. I mean, there are things you can... There are a few things that are across the board obvious misuses of sexuality, you know, rape or child molestation. You know, you can't find any justification for behavior like that. But after you get past the really super obvious things that anybody can agree on, you're in a kind of pathless land in a way in which the behavior itself, you can't categorically say, okay, this is wrong. Some people got a little... I've received a few comments already, and the book's only been out like a week, about people worried that I don't condemn, for example, S&M, the S&M scene at all.
Yeah, let's talk about S&M.
Yeah, that's, okay, sure, on the spirituality program.
Sure, why not? Listener discretion is advised. We're going to be talking about, S&M. So that's sadism and masochism, pain.
That's right. And some people have been kind of squeamish that I mentioned this in the book without condemning it. But I ended up a little bit... I wouldn't say I was involved in that scene at all, but a girlfriend of mine was working at an S&M dungeon, you know, at the time when she was not one of the S&Mers. She was the receptionist, but she had a lot of contact with the people in that scene, and I got to meet them. And among others, one of them was she wasn't a Zen Buddhist, but she was a longtime follower of, I think, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and actually used it as part of her work in ways that she explained to me in more detail than I needed to know.
Interesting.
But I felt like in that scene there's a very strong emphasis on everyone participating in the act of sex, you know, or whatever it is. Sometimes it's not even sex in their case. That everybody has to be very, very clear on what their intentions are and what they will do and what they won't do and where they're coming from and what they expect. And I thought that kind of clarity would be really useful in so-called, you know, in quotes, normal sexual relationships. I think we could all use a bit more of that. You know, it's because of the nature of the what they're doing that it requires you to be clear about, you know, how far you're going to go and what your intentions are. But really, I think they're kind of acknowledging something that those of us who are not engaged in that sort of scene don't acknowledge, which is that this is important stuff. This is potentially dangerous stuff. You know, any kind of sex you get involved with includes a certain amount of, you know, danger, not just in terms of physical danger, but in terms of emotional danger and this kind of thing. You know, you're opening up to someone and all that. And if we were able to bring that kind of clarity to it, we might all be better off.
So I'm curious, why, Brad, do you think that, for example, I came from a Catholic background and there's a whole lot of guilt around sex in the Catholic religion. And then, of course, then you see some Catholic priests molesting little boys because arguably perhaps it's because their sexuality has been so repressed that they're having to find other outlets for it. And that's where it manifests. Mm-hmm. So why do you think that so many of the major religions of the world are so hell-bent on repressing people sexually?
Well, it might be because of that thing that I mentioned before, which is that religions tend to take the view that spirit, the spiritual side of our being, is the most important thing, and that it should come first, and that the material side of our being is either bad or non-existent. So so when it comes to sex, that is seen by most sort of religious-minded people as being a completely materialistic bodily thing, and because it's of the body, it's base and lower, and we should avoid that and get into the higher things of the spirit. But you know, Buddhism doesn't take the view that the body is base and low and the spirit is pure. It's something that encompasses both. So, and also this idea of sin, which is one that I write about in the book a lot, doesn't exist in Buddhism. So this idea that there's an unseen and unknowable God viewing your acts here on earth, and you don't know what he's thinking about them, really. You get these sort of vague impressions, but you know he's thinking something. He's got an opinion. I mean, that's the sort of image I get. And that leads to a lot of guilt and shame and all of this other stuff, because you kind of don't know what this imaginary father figure is thinking about what you've done, although he's seen it, you know, which also makes you kind of feel ashamed.
So we talk about, I'm curious that about if there's no sin in Buddhism, but there is the idea of karma, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you are doing something like you talked about in the S&M community, it's everything is very clearly laid out. There's things like a safe word, so that one would hope that would be, boundaries would be respected to a degree, and everyone kind of knows what they're going to be getting out of that experience, and there's no hurt feelings at the end and cheating and things like that. So what's your opinion on our Western daily relationships where there's so much infidelity in marriage? I mean, people take these vows that they're going to be true to one another, and then they just go and like sleep with other people, and hearts get broken and families are torn apart. I mean, from a karmic standpoint, what's your view on that?
Well, karma is action, and Buddhism has this view that any action you take, like any physical action, has a reaction. You know, we know that, and we're well acquainted with that because we have a very scientifically based society which accepts this view. Buddhism just kind of, and Buddhism and Hinduism also have the same idea, which extends this into the realm of just I suppose moral action, saying that everything has a reaction, including in the realm of the mind or in the realm of the spirit, so things will come back to you. So the point is that there's not sinful behavior, but there is behavior which will lead to unwanted consequences. I almost said bad, but you know, it's hard to say bad or good at some level. So you have to be careful what you engage in, because you're aware that you're not going to get away with anything. That's sort of the idea of karma, is that, you know, we have this notion that we can do something nasty to a person and we can just get away without any sort of consequences. And the point of view in Buddhism has always been that doesn't happen, which is hard for people to accept. It's one of the hardest points because it's almost impossible to prove. But in my experience, in my practice, I've seen that happen so often that I can't deny it anymore, just because of my own experience. And if somebody wants to argue about it, well, that's fine. They can argue about it. But my experience tells me that everything I do has some kind of consequences, even in the sort of moral realm of, you know, cheating somebody or lying to somebody or anything like that. And so I accept it. So in this case, in terms of sexuality, you need to behave in a, you know, I don't know any other word to say, but in a moral fashion, so that the consequences of your actions are better for you. It's an almost selfish point of view, but it's not selfish in the sense of I want to get, you know, everything for myself. It's selfish in the sense that it's sensibly selfish. You know that you're going to personally suffer if you hurt somebody, so you know that's one good reason not to do it, and also because you don't want to hurt somebody else. So ultimately, you're the same person, but that's getting into a little bit of deep Buddhism there.
Well, it's kind of like the golden rule: do to others what you would want them to do to you.
That's right, yeah.
Hopefully, yeah. Okay, great. Well, it's time for a break, so we will be back again in a moment. We are speaking with Brad Warner. He is the author of the brand new book, Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. We'll be back with more synchronicity in a moment.
Strength.
Dignity.
Respect.
Beauty.
Self-worth.
Safety.
Confidence.
Choice.
Hope.
The Beauty Night Society is a registered charity dedicated to helping marginalized women introduce trust, hope, and self-esteem into their lives. This is the
first day of Through its popular makeover program, the Beauty Night Society has touched the lives of thousands and reintroduced a healthy touch to the lives of vulnerable women throughout British Columbia, creating real life makeovers.
Please visit www.beautynight.org for information on programs and on how to help. Beauty Night, because dignity is beautiful. I think I was blind
before I met you. Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and that ad, the Beauty Night Society, that's actually an organization developed by Caroline from CITR's very own Sexy in Van City, which airs Wednesday nights here on CITR 101.9 FM. So if you're enjoying this discussion about sex, definitely want to listen to Sexy in Van City because it gets way messier down there over at nighttime. So yeah, they talk about all sorts of stuff. Sexy in Van City here on CITR 101.9. This is Synchronicity, and we're talking about spirituality and sexuality. And our guest today is Brad Warner. He's the author of Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. If you want to get on the air and ask him a question, the number to call is 604-822-2487. That's 604-822-2487. Welcome back to the show, Brad.
Hello.
Hi. So we were... Pardon?
It's Sexy in Van City.
Yeah.
Okay,
and it gets... after a certain time on the community radio, you can drop F-bombs on the radio.
Oh, wow.
And so that happens a lot, and they talk about... And she talks in a really sexy voice, and
wow,
yeah, it's an interesting show.
Get on that show, too.
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot of fun over there. Okay, so we are talking about Zen Buddhism and sexuality. And now we're talking, you were mentioning about karma and morals related to when you're engaging in sex with another person or persons. But I mean, some of the things that go on in, for example, the S&M, the BDSM community, some of that stuff is just, it would be hard to, I mean, it's maybe not child abuse or rape, but it's really pushing the boundaries of what's moral.
Sure, and one of the things I mentioned, although I don't know, some people seem, I wonder if I mentioned it clearly enough, because some of the people who've asked me about this don't seem to have noticed this, which is one of the, you know, I had a lot of discussions with the woman I was seeing who was at the S&M dungeon, and saw and heard about a lot of things I didn't actually see, you know, the actual sessions or anything. But it struck me that there are times when these activities, and this doesn't just go for BDSM, it goes for a lot of things, where the activities can be completely consensual and everybody can agree to it, but it can still be not right, I think is probably the best way to put it, because I don't want to be too judgmental, but it's something that's causing both parties a certain amount of damage because they aren't clear in themselves about what is acceptable. So they'll go into something not really knowing themselves very well, and they'll agree to do this activity, and then you know, afterwards or maybe even during, realize that this is not a good thing to do. Or maybe they never realize it. They just get more and more damaged. And I saw some of that go on, which is why I, you know, ultimately the book is about Buddhist practice, and one of the aspects of Zen Buddhist practice is looking very, very deeply into your own body and mind, and seeing yourself for what you are in a very unadorned and direct way. And once you've kind of done that, I mean, it's an ongoing process. You're never really finished with it, but you become clearer about what is and isn't acceptable to you, and you're going to be probably less likely to do things that are going to cause yourself and others harm because you just see it more clearly.
So, and maybe this is hard for you to say, but I'll just throw it out there. Someone who is on a spiritual path, and I'm not talking about religion here, but getting clear within themselves, I mean, wouldn't you expect that someone who is on that path wouldn't still get off on either inflicting great pain on another person or having that inflicted on them?
Well, it's difficult for me to say, like you said, because I don't have that specific inclination, but it was kind of fascinating talking to some of the members of this community, because I don't know if I agree with this or not, but a lot of them are very adamant that what is going on in their communities is a sexual orientation, you know, like being a homosexual or being bisexual or whatever, and that this is the way that they are able to enjoy sex. And so it's a matter of connecting with other people, you know, because obviously that's a rare form of sexual enjoyment. But it's a matter of connecting with other people who truly have that inclination as well. So it's difficult for me to say that can't be combined with being on a spiritual path. My feeling is, though, that one of the things that happens with in the practice that I've been involved with is that you become more and more sensitive, both physically and spiritually, I suppose, to use that word. And because of this, I would imagine that your likelihood to, you know, to need severe stimulation like what you get in some of that community would lessen over time. But you know, it's hard to say.
Okay, because when you talk about it being a sexual orientation, I mean, generally, like if you compare that to homosexuality, it's not homosexuality is something that you're born with. You're born gay or you're born straight, right? Someone who... Pardon?
I mean, that's the thinking. You know, I don't know. I mean, I getting into that area is like a big,
Okay. Well, generally, that's fairly accepted that people are born with an orientation. But with fetishes or BDSM, I mean, if you talk to someone who has a fetish for whatever, they will, I mean, as far as I know, almost always, they will say that there was some kind of event that happened in childhood that, like, I used to know a guy who really wanted me to wear my hair in a ponytail, and he really got off on that because when he was in grade 2, his really hot teacher wore a ponytail, and so that was like a fetish of his. And I know that's pretty mild as far as fetishes go, but I mean, it always seems to stem from childhood.
Yeah, I mean, this is getting into an area which is outside my area of expertise, but my feeling on the subject, though, and I think this has something to do with the Zen practice, is that we are, I think, born with certain inclinations, across the board, not just sexually, but that we do. This is part of the Zen practice, is it makes you aware of how powerful, how incredibly powerful your brain is at overriding whatever natural impulses you have, and again, in any area, not just sexuality. So I feel that it's always a mix, you know, whether you're born with this or not, it's always a mixture, even heterosexual behavior. I think just because most people tend to be heterosexually inclined, that leads to us being socialized, generally speaking, in a heterosexual way, and that there's a lot of stuff, a lot of events and things that are going into your mind and body that are causing you to be inclined in a so-called normal heterosexual way as well, as what would happen if you have a fetish or something. So it's all about how the brain can kind of take anything and form it into part of the ego, and then the ego structure becomes very strong, and then you're inclined to follow what your ego structure is telling you to do. But the ego structure isn't always right, or it's often terribly wrong, and that's where the whole Buddhism thing comes in.
Wonderful. Okay, so if you want to get on the air and ask Brad a question, the number is 604-822-2487, 604-822-2487. We're speaking with Brad Warner. He's the author of Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. Now, you have a chapter on Zen and porn.
Yeah.
And I really would like to know more about that, because you talk about as long as it's not harming anyone else, as long as it's consensual. And there's a lot of debate about porn. I mean, even if a girl signs up and she goes and gets paid X amount of dollars to do the movie, there's so much exploitation. Most of these girls have suffered from some kind of sexual abuse. I mean, how do you make that feel moral?
It's a very difficult question, and I don't know if I'm coming across with exactly what I want to say, because it's such a difficult question. I don't see pornography as something that's, across the board a good thing, to just put it in big red capital letters. But what I see it as is something that's not going to go away, that's part of our real world. And as a Buddhist, the thing that you need to do is be aware of what reality actually is. And you can kind of fantasize about a perfect world in which there is no pornography. We could talk about that, and I might agree with you that that would be better. But that's not the world we live in. So it doesn't really matter if it would be better or not. What matters is what sort of world we're living in. And what I would like to see is, I can't see pornography going away anytime soon. It would take a huge, unless civilization destroys itself or something, and then we have to rebuild again, and then we're going to rebuild the pornography. But since it's not going away, what the thing to do about it would be to say, okay, let's try to make this better. And I want to come out in support of the incremental gains that are being made these days in trying to make pornography a little better, giving the women who are involved more choice and more say and more control over the images that they're presenting and so on and so forth. And I don't feel like anybody's really gotten there and made it as good as it ought to be. But I do feel that there are steps being taken gradually to reduce some of the exploitation, and people are getting smarter. It's the same as a musician. The same thing is happening in the music business, and what it's ended up causing is the collapse of the recording industry, because musicians used to be terribly, exploited. People would sign away all their rights and never get anything. And now that's gotten better, and I think the same thing is going to happen in pornography as more younger women get educated, and then there's an understanding of what you're actually entering into in this. I think it's inevitably going to get better, and I'd like to see that happen. But it's a steaming awful cesspool even now, and I think I put that in the book.
Well, so Brad, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like what you're saying is that pornography, the idea of pornography, isn't necessarily a negative thing, but of course the world of pornography has a lot that needs to be fixed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the fact of there are naked, sexually stimulating pictures of naked people. I mean, I don't think that's either good or bad. But there's a lot more to it than just that.
All right, fair enough. Well, it's time for another break. We are speaking with Brad Warner. He is the author of the brand new book, Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. If you want to get on the air and ask Brad a question, the number to call is 604-822-2487. That's 604-822-2487. We'll be back with more synchronicity in just a second.
Rude boys, don't cry, don't cry.
Rude boy, don't cry.
Scenic Drive, every Friday morning, 10 a.m. till noon, CITR.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. We're speaking today with Brad Warner. He is a Zen Buddhist, and he's also author of Sex, Sin, and Zen. And we'll be talking more with him in just a second. But I want to let you know that if you love Wayne Dyer, if you're a fan of Wayne Dyer and you're in Vancouver, he is coming to Vancouver Tuesday, November 23rd to the Queen Elizabeth Theatre at 7 o'clock. And here's the thing. You need to listen to this show live every week between now and, I guess, the week before the event, because I have 5 pairs of tickets to give away. I don't know when I'm going to give away the tickets on the show. It'll be sometime between now and late November. But if you want a pair of those tickets, they're really, really good seats. They're like $135 seats for one ticket. It's in the orchestra section. So they're really awesome tickets. And if you want to see Wayne Dyer, you better listen each week, Friday, 9 a.m. Pacific, here on CITR 101.9 FM for your chance to score a free pair of tickets to see Wayne Dyer here in Vancouver on Tuesday, November 23rd at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. So welcome back to the show, Brad.
Hello.
Hi. So you're a... How do you... When I said you were a Zen Buddhist monk, you... Kind of, it sounds like you don't necessarily define yourself that way.
Yeah, but it's a hard definition because the words that we've got in English for these things are from the Catholic tradition. So you've got monk, nun, priest, and they have been, you know, sort of shoehorned in. Shoehorned is probably not the word, but, you know, it's an ill fit for what a Buddhist monk really is. In the Zen tradition, for example, when you think of a monk, in the Catholic tradition, it's a person who enters a monastery and stays in the monastery for the rest of his life. And if he should leave the monastery, then he's no longer a monk. And that's pretty much the opposite of what happens in the Zen lineage. In which case, if you become a monk, you are expected to stay. Maybe not even stay in the monastery at all, or if you do stay in a monastery, you stay there for a short time, you know, maybe a maximum of 2 years, you know, maybe even just 3 months or something. And then you are expected to leave the monastery. If you stay in the monastery too long, that's not, they'll kick you out. So it's quite different. But my teacher used the word monk when he ordained me, and so that's the word I use.
All right, fair enough. Well, thank you. I just want to let people know that you're not just some random dude who decided to write about sex and say, yeah, you can, like, sleep with whoever you want, do whatever you want, and it's all good.
I don't know if I say that, but yeah.
All right, cool. So let's talk about women in Buddhism and women and sexuality, because I was just talking with someone the other day about Buddha's wife.
Right.
And Siddhartha, the developer of Buddhism, actually left his wife in the middle of the night.
Right after their first child or their only child had been born.
Yes, and didn't really want women to be joining and following along with what became Buddhism later on. So, I mean, if the guy who created Buddhism is kind of trying to keep himself away from women, then isn't it strange now that you're writing about sexuality and Buddhism?
Yeah, well, Buddhist story is you know, comes from a different time in a different place. So he did leave his wife to join to go on his quest, but he didn't just leave her in a roach infested apartment in the on her own. She was cared for by an extended family, and that was the tradition. And there was a tradition of home leaving. That doesn't make it less painful, I'm sure, for her, but it wasn't, it wasn't the same as some guy now just, leaving his wife to go on a spiritual quest and end up in Los Angeles in a convertible or whatever. So there's that. And then when the situation where he barred women from the Buddhist order, he was asked by his main attendant, Ananda, because Ananda, actually Buddha's wife, ended up becoming part of the order, and I'll kind of get to that. But she, among other people, was asking to join the order, and Ananda said, well, why don't you allow women? Are women less intelligent than men? And Buddha said, no, women are just as intelligent as men. And he said, well, are women less capable of becoming enlightened than men? And Buddha said, no, they're just as capable of becoming enlightened as a man is. And so Ananda said, well, then why don't you establish an order for women? And Buddha said, he couldn't argue with that logic. But the society in India at the time was strongly opposed to that. So he was, I'm not sure if he was the first Indian religious figure to establish a female order of monks, but he was among the first, certainly, if not the very first. And as time went on, other Buddhists sort of refined that view till when you get to Dogen, who was the founder of the sect that I was ordained in the 1200s, in Japan, he wrote an essay called Praising That Which Has Attained the Marrow, and attaining the marrow means attaining the deepest understanding of Buddhism. And in that, he kind of, it's almost like a rant in which he really very strongly criticizes anyone who thinks that women are less capable of understanding Buddhism than men, because even in his time in the 1200s in Japan, it was very strong prejudice against women. And he just makes it very, very clear that this is the wrong point of view, and that women or anyone, in fact, regardless of their gender or regardless of their race, is just equally capable of attaining the marrow, of attaining the deepest understanding of Buddhism, and that no one should be categorically looked down upon for this reason.
Okay, cool. Fair enough. And there's one story in your book, Brad, mm-hmm. about you're in, I think it's San Francisco, at some kind of orgasm religion type of place.
Oh, right, yeah.
Can you tell us more about that? That was interesting.
Yeah, that was kind of a weird thing. I was invited by a friend to go to this place called the Orgasmic Meditation. It was a center for orgasmic meditation. And he showed me and he introduced me to the woman who invented this orgasmic meditation technique, I suppose, and it involves having a woman lay down and a man bring her to orgasm, and they do this in a way that's supposed to enhance the spirituality of the event, or whatever we want to call it. And I listened. They didn't invite me back to see any of this, but the thing that I write about in the book, which I think is kind of telling, is I was looking at, and there's these gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous women just going in the back room to have, this orgasm meditation going, and I was going, man, I want to go, see them naked. and I'm thinking, well, I'm thinking this, and I'm kind of open to what I, my own reaction you know, every heterosexual man in that room is thinking the same thing. But it seemed to me that there was a very strong attitude within the place that sort of thing needs to be repressed, or not just repressed, but denied. And it seemed somewhat dishonest in the end, but not dishonest in a kind of deliberate way of trying to steal people's money or anything. I had the feeling the people involved in this were sincere, but they were perhaps not quite understanding themselves all that well. And also, I don't think that there are spiritual aspects to the act of sex that you know, people have known about for years. In the Buddhist tradition, we have the tantric tradition, which acknowledges and celebrates this. I've never been involved in tantric Buddhism, but they acknowledge and celebrate sexuality and sometimes use it as a form of meditation. But in that case, you have to go through years, I think decades of training before you're actually turned loose, you know, into the actual realm of sex. Whereas the people I visited in San Francisco, they give you like a week or something of training, and then, you know, bang, you're in. And I think that's a little bit reckless, because this is a very hot area you're dealing with. Whereas when we're in the Zen tradition, what we're doing as our meditation is perhaps the polar opposite of that. It's the most boring thing you can possibly think of. You're sitting on a cushion straight up looking at a blank wall, you know, and trying to see the truth there. And it's very unstimulating and very unexciting. And I think that's the way you need to start, you know, and then eventually once you kind of get comfortable with that, then we can start to see where the meditative state occurs during sex.
But Brad, you mentioned that in the orgasmic meditation center, that it was all the women were brought to orgasm. But what about the guys? Did they just not get anything out of it?
Yeah, that was an interesting thing too, because I asked the same question, and apparently they do have a more advanced sessions where the men are brought to orgasm by the women, but this is somehow considered to be a different thing, and I don't know, it seemed to be very kind of off balance. You know, as a guy, I can say I'm sure the men got something out of it, you know. But,
Fill in the spank bank.
yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. I didn't want to go that way. But yeah, that's it.
Well, very interesting. I can only imagine what that must have been like. And it sounds almost like it has, minus the S&M aspect, it does almost sound like there's some kind of domination aspect where, at least from when the women are experiencing this, it would almost be like the women are the ones in control and the men have to withhold themselves.
Yeah, I suppose that's part of, you know, they talked about the discipline of that and so on. And I suppose that's part of it, you know. And then, you know, the act of control, that goes back and forth, because in orgasm, I mean, that's kind of the definition of it, I think, in some circles involves the loss of control. You know, at that moment, you have, I was just listening to a podcast about what happens during orgasm, and there was something about you lose a lot of your, what is it called? Direct control of your body, your voluntary control. You just kind of, you know, for a few seconds, a lot of that shuts down. So, you know, that's another aspect of it.
Interesting. So you're giving up, you're expected to have control, one partner, and then another partner's losing control. Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are speaking, it's time for another break. We're speaking with Brad Warner. He is the author of Sex, Sin, and Zen. We just have a few minutes left in the show, so if you do want to get on the air and ask him a question about sex and Zen, give us a call, 604-822-2487. And this is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we'll be back in a moment.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Center offers support services to survivors of sexual assault and other forms of violence, as well as their friends, family members, and partners. They are committed to education and the support of students, staff, faculty, and visitors of all genders. They offer counseling, accompaniments, information, and referrals. They also facilitate specialized workshops and training sessions, develop public education campaigns, and hold special events related to anti-violence work. All services are free and confidential. For more information on programs and services, or on volunteer opportunities, visit their website, www.ams.ubc.ca/SASC.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Coming up in about 15 minutes is Ska T's Scenic Drive, so stick around for that. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we're speaking with Brad Warner. He is a Zen Buddhist, you could call him a Zen Buddhist monk, and he is the author of Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. Welcome back to the show, Brad.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask you where is a good place to pick up this book in just a moment, but I'm looking, your publicist sent a letter with some sample questions, and I see on here, can Zen practice help someone get more sex?
Yeah.
So a lot of people might want to know that.
Yeah, I've been asked that question a lot, and that's why she put that on there. We discussed it. The answer is I don't know. I think, though, my suspicion is that it could be used that way, because it tends to make you more clear on who you are and what you are, and it does tend to be a practice that results in the gaining of self-confidence, which, you know, as everybody knows, is very attractive sexually. So I know it's been a huge boost for me. It's kind of interesting that a practice that is engaged in discovering that you have no self can result in you having a lot of self-confidence, because it sort of dissolves the false view that you have of who and what you are, and allows what you actually are to become more clear, which gives you a certain, you know, confidence may not even be the right word, but it gives you a kind of a stronger sense of what your role is. And also, in the very act of sex, like I said, you become more focused because of the practice and more sensitive. So everything becomes a lot clearer and better. You know, washing the dishes becomes clearer and better. You know, cleaning the cat box becomes clearer and better. And so obviously sex will become clearer and better, and you will have less of a tendency to sort of zone out or lose touch, or become, you know, nervous and not be able to perform, and these kind of things tend to sort themselves out.
Okay, that brings up a question for me, because I very briefly dated a man who said he was Buddhist.
Mm.
And he was not... I don't know, whatever.
He wasn't
that great on many levels, and mentioned this to him, and just how he had done something kind of disrespectful, and his answer was basically that he was a Buddhist, and so he saw it as that it was my problem that I had to deal with and get over. And I was like, okay, but if you're doing something that affects me, and it's something that is, you know, it's not just something like that you inadvertently, you know, can't help that it's going to impact someone else, but you're actually doing something that is harming another person. I mean, how can that be Buddhism? So where do you think he might have picked that up from?
I'm not sure. I mean, I just listening to what little I'm getting of the story here, I agree with you. That seems to be a wrong application of Buddhism. But then, you know, you can wrongly apply anything, so, you know, it's no surprise. I'm not sure. A lot of people get kind of confused in Buddhism, and you do see this this attitude where, you know, that's your problem kind of thing cropping up among people who get confused about Buddhism. But it's not the right way of looking at things. And everything that we encounter is our problem. Even if it's actually your problem, it's still my problem because you and I, and me and everyone, are not so different. We're not separate. We have this wrong view that we are all separate beings interacting independently of each other, and that's just not the case. I mean, there is a certain aspect of life in which you can say we are independent beings, but we're not eternally separate. We affect each other. So anything... So I really don't know where he would have gotten that idea, although that's not the first time that I've heard of that... that attitude coming out.
Is that the idea of detachment?
Yeah, it might be. And that's a good point. A lot of people misunderstand the Buddhist view of non-attachment as the Buddhist view of detachment, wherein you try to be more eternally separate than, you know, like ultimately eternally separate. They'll see this sort of non-attachment view as being, you know, I am the ultimately non-attached thing, and what other people and other things I interact with do is just beyond me totally. And that's completely the wrong way of thinking, I think, because we're ultimately very much attached to each other in that sense.
All right. So, Brad, I do have a couple more questions for you, but before we get into that, where can people pick up your book?
Well, it's out now, and it should be available at any good bookstore. I know you have chapters up there in Canada. It's also available through Amazon, and then I have a blog with nice little links that'll get you right to the Amazon pages for my books, and that's hardcorezen.blogspot.com.
Hardcore Zen.
Or your local bookstore.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Chapters is a pretty big store, so I'd like to encourage people to go to the neighborhood smaller stores because they probably need your income a little bit more. So, Brad, you also lived in Japan for a while, and I can't remember if it was on the show or just in conversation how I was discussing this just the other day, how in Japan, isn't it pretty common for men to have mistresses?
Oh, sure, yeah. It's becoming less common these days as younger people get more steeped in the sort of Western attitudes that say that's not really the best way to behave. But, you know, part of it has to do with the Japanese have an entirely different understanding of sex from what we do. There's no sin involved and so on. So, you know, I can't really condone the idea of having mistresses and so on outside of marriages, you know, or the women will also have their own, you know, things outside of marriage, and that's rather common. But it may be an acknowledgement of the fact that I feel like the idea of monogamy is very interesting because I believe in the research that says human beings are basically pair-bonding creatures who want to stay with one partner for a length of time. But we've extended that to a lifetime linking up, which may not be our natural inclination, which is not to say that it can't happen, but it is saying, I think, that if you want to try to have a lifetime pair bond, that's going to take some work, and you're going to be actually overcoming some of your natural inclinations. And I think it's worthwhile in this case to perhaps overcome some of those natural inclinations for a sort of a better life, but I think our society doesn't really acknowledge that. It sort of wants us to believe that our natural inclination is to be pair bonded for life, and that if that doesn't work out, well, you've done something wrong. And I think in the cases where those lifelong pair bondings don't work out, it might be just a case of the natural inclinations kind of taking over. And of course, it causes pain and suffering, and that's why perhaps it's better to try to sort of settle into something and go, okay, well, I don't have to give in to all of my inclinations.
So it sounds like serial monogamy is kind of the most natural thing for people.
I mean, that's what it seems to be in my observation. Not that I'm any tremendous expert on the subject, but just from personal experience and so on. But I do see the value of lifetime pair bonding and marriage. You know, where it stays steady for a long, long time. It's just that we have to acknowledge that this is something that's something we've invented, maybe not invented, but, you know, it's something that's good for us that we've invented, but it's going to take work.
And so, Brad, what are you intending for people to really take home from your book, Sex, Sin, and Zen?
It's interesting because that question comes up in interviews a lot, and I never know how to answer. I was reading the introduction to some very popular spiritual book where the guy says, you know, I would feel so wonderful every time I sold one of the books because I knew it had power to change people's lives. And I never feel like that with my own books. I'm like, you know, I hope people laugh at the jokes, you know. But if anything, I would hope that I really do believe in the Zen Buddhist philosophy and practice, or I wouldn't have stuck with it for, you know, 26 or 27 years or however long it's been. So obviously I do believe it, but I'm not out to proselytize for it. I think I would like to present it and let people know that it's available and say, well, this is one way of looking at things. And if you want to try it for yourself, please do so. But there's no sense in me trying to convert anyone.
And Brad, I really want to thank you for being on the show today. It's been such a pleasure. And I have to say that there are a lot of jokes. Your writing is very blunt and to the point and humorous. So I've really been enjoying reading the book Sex, Sin, and Zen. Thank you so much for being with us today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave us with?
No, that's okay. I'm really happy to get to talk about this subject, and I'm really hoping that you know, that this book becomes a contribution to people becoming more aware of their own sex lives and how it affects others and so on. So, you know, don't get the book.
Wonderful. Okay, so again, the name of the book is Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. And Brad's blog is hardcorezen.blogspot.com. So the hardcore, is that like the hardcore rock and roll, or is that the hardcore sex?
Well, it's kind of both. It comes from my first book was called Hardcore Zen, based on the whole idea of hardcore punk, which we called it hardcore punk based on the, you know, hardcore porn, you know, sort of like using that analogy. You know, the porn, the kind of porn that shows you everything, you know, the kind of punk rock that opens everything and the kind of Zen that opens everything up to view.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure reading your book and so fun speaking with you about sex on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. You
bye-bye.
Too.
So again, that was Brad Warner. He is the author of Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between. And again, his blog is hardcorezen.blogspot.com. And you can pick up the book. It's brand new. Should be out in all bookstores, online, and in the real world. So this has been Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks so much for being with me today. Thank you for listening to the discussion on sex. I hope it didn't offend anyone, but I've had a really good time talking about sex. And if you want to hear more sexy themed things on CITR, you can listen to Sexy in Van City on Wednesday nights here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. So coming up next is Scotty's Scenic Drive. Have a fantastic weekend. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Lullabies for Grownups. The Moon by Kate Kohler. Have a wonderful day.